fields of bodies burning as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Hi, this is Bob Petrakis bringing you the other side of the news.
And I'm Dan Dugan, the other guy on the other side. WGRN, the Green Renaissance.
This is Bob Petrakis with the other side of the news with a special presentation. Khaled El-Gindi is gracing our studio today, at least he's calling in, but he's going to be in town. He's going to be here on October 2nd from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The title of the event, Prospects for Peace in Israel-Palestine, Deal of the Century or End of the Road. And that is being sponsored in part by Students for Justice in Palestine, OSU, Jewish Voices for Peace, Central Ohio, and Central Ohioans for Peace. The location, the Houston House Building 1102 is the address, 97 West Lane Avenue. So there's also parking available in the South Ohio Union parking. Now let's tell you a little about Khaled El-Gindi. He's the author of a new book. Khaled wrote Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians, From Belfort to Trump. He is a non-resident fellow in the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution, where he was a resident fellow from, it looks like, 2010 to 2018. Prior to that, he served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations. And that was from 2004 to 2009. Also, he was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations held throughout 2008. Welcome to the other side of the news, Khaled.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Okay, so we're looking at your background here. Obviously, you've been deeply involved in this process. One of the questions I've wondered about is all those giant ads that have been appearing for a few years in the New York Times, where it looks like the military and intelligence officers, top levels in Israel, keep attacking Netanyahu's policy, claiming, you know, if this doesn't, there's not a change, there's no two-state solution possible. What are we to make of that when we see those giant ads with all these military generals and these intelligence, top-level intelligence officers?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, one of the dynamics that we've seen over the past few years, really, is this kind of gradual but very distinct shift in Israeli politics to the right. So with each election cycle, the Israeli government kind of lurches to the right. And Netanyahu is trying to keep up with that rightward surge in Israeli politics. And so what that has done is kind of put him more and more at odds with the more centrist, I guess, more pragmatic military establishment in Israel, which is focused on trying to resolve, on some level, the conflict with the Palestinians. Whereas Netanyahu, in order to kind of placate his ever increasingly rightward base, has to kind of become more and more extreme. And so he's now even talking about annexation. of what they call Judea and Samaria, of course, referring to the West Bank. And so there really is a divide, I think, in Israeli politics between the military and intelligence establishment and the kind of right-wing policies that we've seen pushed by Netanyahu's government.
When we think about, his attempt to annex, going back to 1948, what's the territory look like? You know, every now and then I glance at a map and it seems like there was a much more equitable distribution initially.
Well, it depends on which map you're looking at. In 1947, there was a map of, based on the United Nations partition plan, to divide what was then Palestine into two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state.
Mm-hmm.
Would it have been something like 55% of the land allotted to the Jewish state and 45% to the Arab state. But by the end of the fighting in 1948, Israel's borders were much bigger. So it sort of canceled the would-be Arab state of Palestine and essentially controlled about 78% of the country, leaving the remaining 22% being the West Bank and Gaza. After 1967, of course, Israel occupied those remaining territories and has been expanding, especially in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, through building settlements and moving settlers into those areas in order to ensure that that land would never go back to Arabs or become part of a Palestinian state.
And again, the Golan Heights, which has emerged under Trump with annexation, isn't that Syrian territory?
Yeah, so what happened in 1967 is Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, being the Palestinian territories, but also occupied the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt and the Golan Heights mm-hmm. from Syria. And, of course, after the Camp David Accords and the Egypt-Israel Peace Treaty, Israel withdrew from the Sinai, which went back to Egypt. And all that was left were, the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan Heights. And now, kind of reversing American policy for more than half a century, the Trump administration has decided to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which the international community considers occupied territory. Removed any possibility that the Golan Heights would be part of some future negotiated settlement between Israel and Syria.
Now, where does that fall under international law? Is there some basis for, particularly I'm thinking, a outside sovereign, the United States, kind of sanctioning the taking of occupied territory from another nation?
Yeah, the UN Charter is pretty clear in the prohibition of the acquisition of territory by force. And that principle was reiterated after the war in 1967 in UN Security Council Resolution 242, which became the basis of the peace process going forward. And that resolution required Israel to withdraw from the territories that it occupied in exchange for peace and normalization with its Arab neighbors. And so it's a basic principle that of international law, that might does not make right. Simply because you have the military power to take over territory does not give you a rightful claim to that territory. What Trump has done in recognizing Israeli sovereignty and what Israel has done in annexing the Golan Heights, of course, is illegal under international law.
Now, you've been intimately involved as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership and involved in negotiations. Is peace possible? Right? I mean, every time you talk to people, they say, well, it's never going to happen. But is there a chance for peace?
I do think peace is possible. I mean, at the end of the day, this is a conflict between humans. It's a man-made conflict, and it has, at least ostensibly, theoretically, a man-made solution or solutions. You know, this is not an act of God. This is not a natural disaster. This is, you know, these are human endeavors that we're dealing with. So, of course, there's a solution. It's a question of whether whether you have leaders in place who are willing to make difficult decisions in order to get to a solution, but also whether there's a process in place to help the parties get there. And I think, you know, that's sort of the impetus of my book, which was looking at American mediation.
First, let me stop you right there. Wouldn't some disagree that that the U.S. has actually been mediating and in some ways may have been less than neutral in many cases?
Yeah, it's true. I don't think even the United States would claim that they were an even-handed mediator or broker. But the idea was always that the United States could be an effective broker, even if it wasn't entirely even-handed or, you know, unbiased. Of course it's biased. Everyone knows that the United States has a special relationship with Israel, that pro-Israel forces in American domestic politics are very powerful in influencing the direction of U.S. policy on Israel and Palestine. Those are not, you know, earth-shattering bits of news. Everyone knows this. But the idea was that somehow on those issues that mattered the most, the United States could still be counted on as the world's only superpower, as Israel's friend, you know, to kind of compel Israel to do what was in its best interest for peace, which up until the Trump administration was to have a solution based on two states, a state of Israel alongside an independent state of Palestine. So that was the goal. Turns out that it's not enough to have goals. You actually have to have a credible process in place to get the parties there. And in that sense, American mediation is pretty unique in terms of other third-party mediators. And not just because it failed. You know, lots of third parties fail in their mediation. But, you know, there are idiosyncrasies. American mediation is very idiosyncratic based on the fact that it's a superpower. As I mentioned, its relationship, very, very close relationship with Israel, the influence of domestic politics in a particular direction. All of these things affect how it functions as a mediator. And so what I'm essentially arguing is that the United States didn't just try and fail. Their style of mediation actually made matters worse on the ground and a diplomatic solution more difficult to achieve.
All right. You're listening to a special episode of The Other Side of the News. I'm Bob Fetrakis, and this is WGRN 94.1. I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, author of Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians, From Balfour to Trump. What is that blind spot that you're talking about here?
Yeah, so in a normal mediation situation, you have a third party that looks at the two sides of a conflict, looks at the power dynamics between the two sides, right? Because there's always a stronger party and a weaker party. In this case, Israel is clearly the stronger party. Israel is occupying the other party. So it has many, many more levers at its disposal, right? So a mediator has to look at the power dynamics between the two sides and then look at the domestic political situation on each side. Each side, of course, has an opposition, has anti-peace elements that need to be somehow neutralized or somehow dealt with. And then, of course, there's a regional context. There's regional geopolitics happening. And so mediator looks at all of these moving parts and says, what is the best way to use this situation and come up with a way to incentivize each side to do what they need to do in order to get to a peaceful resolution? And that means if one party is much, much stronger than the other party, then you have to look at the possibility of using pressure with the stronger party. But what the United States has done, and the central kind of guiding assumption of U.S. policy for the past 25 years, has been, first, that Israel cannot be pressured. Israel must, in fact, be reassured at every step. Or to put it another way, Israel has to be hugged into making concessions for peace so that they feel comfortable to take those kinds of risks for peace. And on the other hand, if pressure is going to be applied, it should be applied mainly, if not exclusively, on the Palestinians. And so what you end up with is if you're only pressuring the weak side and hugging and not pressuring, providing only carrots to the stronger side, then you end up kind of deepening that power imbalance. And we've seen that time and time again. We saw it at Camp David. We saw it at Annapolis. We saw it during the Intifada, during the years of when the Palestinian uprising broke out after the failed Camp David summit in 2000, in the early 2000s, years of violence, we saw pressure being put exclusively on one side sort of giving a green light or giving sort of a pass to the Israeli side. Whether it's settlements or Israel's excessive use of violence, we've never seen any meaningful pressure put on the Israeli government. And so the result is that Israelis feel when there's no cost to pursuing those kinds of policies, even though they violate U.S. law and international, or U.S. policy and international law, the will of the international community, when there's not a cost to pursuing those policies that damage chances for peace, that only emboldens the kind of intransigence on the Israeli side. And so it's not a coincidence that we've seen Israeli politics shift more and more to the right, because there's nothing to keep it from moving to the right. There are no constraints on Israeli actions and behaviors, not by the international community, certainly not by the United States, and not by anything that we used to call a peace process.
Well, it seems like the critics in Israel really are basing a lot of their argument on demographics. Is that just this massive problem of long-run demographics with the Palestinian population? And often their big fear seems to be you'll have to have a repressed democracy in a forceful way. Not that they're not already doing that, have a state where the Palestinians conceivably could win election.
Yeah, I mean, I think the dilemma that you just described is one that a lot of folks in Washington are thinking about, that, you know, the left and center left in Israeli politics are thinking about. But you know, this that Israel essentially has to choose. It's either a Jewish state or a democratic, that it will be forced to choose between those two. Because if you continue to rule over 5 million people who are not citizens of your state, well, then that compromises your claim to being a democracy, and increasingly looks more and more like an apartheid situation. If we're talking about permanently disenfranchising, you know, millions of people, so there is a sense of urgency, I think, by progressives, by many in the American Jewish community, by the pro-peace camp in Washington, that Israel is facing this choice. But for the right wing in Israel, their view is that, no, we don't have to be, we can still claim to be a democracy, at least for the Israeli Jewish population and a Jewish state, because there, you know, as I said, there hasn't been a cost to maintaining this status quo of total inequality and disenfranchisement of millions of Palestinians. So to the people who say the current reality is unsustainable, the right wing in Israel says, oh yeah, look at the last 52 years. People have been saying it's unsustainable. And here we are entering, you know, the second half of a half century. You know, we're now well over 50 years into this situation. So they have no reason to believe that the next 50 years would be any different than the last 50 years.
I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, author of Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians, From Belfort to Trump, and one of the co-sponsors of his visit to Columbus on October 2nd, where he will be featured in a talk, Prospects for Peace in Israel and Palestine, Deal of the Century or End of the Road. One of the co-sponsors is Jewish Voices for Peace. Do you think there's more of a debate in Israel? Sometimes when I'm reading the Israeli newspapers or watching some of the international news, there seems to be a far more open debate in Israel than there is in the U.S. Congress.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's one of the many ironies of the situation. You can, and not just in the Israeli parliament, but also in the Israeli media, you have much more diverse views. You have, you know, Palestinian voices, progressive voices being heard saying things like Israel is rapidly becoming an apartheid state, things that are very difficult, if not impossible, to state in our own political culture in this country. So you... You know, you have you've got many more diverse voices in the Israeli arena than you do in Washington, and I think, you know, that's another reason why I wrote this book, is we need to start changing the conversation in Washington about Israel and Palestine. We have not had an honest debate in this country about Israel-Palestine policy, which is a critically important national security and foreign policy issue. We've not had any meaningful debate on this issue in decades. You know, I'm thinking back to maybe the mid-1970s when we had a genuine kind of multiplicity of views represented in something like a congressional hearing. You know, if you look at hearings today, on Capitol Hill, on Israel-Palestine, they're basically a debate between, you know, the Israeli center and the Israeli far right. Palestinian voices are completely absent. Progressive voices are virtually absent. So it's important that we actually start having a debate, because you cannot have sound policy on any issue without kind of hearing the range of views. And that's what has to happen. You know, forget about America leading a peace process. what needs to happen first is America having a conversation, an honest and frank conversation about the whole range of issues related to Israel and Palestine. And that hasn't happened yet.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about Trump. How is Trump contributing to peace in the Middle East?
Well, that's a pretty easy question to answer. He's not. And I don't think, I don't know many Middle East analysts and commentators who look at the Trump plan as being serious. There is, I can only think of one op-ed that I've read in the past 18 months that have treated this Trump plan as something that is serious. You know, I get calls from reporters asking me about the so-called Trump peace plan, or they put it in quotations. So there's a fair amount of, I think, well-deserved skepticism about this plan. And the thing about this plan is that I don't even think they have illusions that it's going to somehow lead to peace. Basically, their plan is to take the status quo, throw some money at the Palestinians, other people's money, not American money, of course, because the United States has been very keen on eliminating every form of assistance to the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. So throwing Arab Gulf money and maybe some European money at the Palestinians, putting a bow around it and saying, that's your new plan. But we know what the plan isn't about. It's not about a sovereign Palestinian state. It's not about a Palestinian capital in Jerusalem. It's not about any kind of equitable resolution to the refugees. And they told us that. Those three issues have been taken off the table. So what's left? Some form of, expanded autonomy, but permanently under Israeli rule. And lots of money, in the best case scenario. So
we're going to have to end there. And people who want to hear more are going to have to come to your talk, October 2nd, 7 to 8:30. Prospects for peace in Israel and Palestine, deal of the century or end of the road. Khaled El-Ghindi, author of Blind Spot: America and Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. Thanks for being on the other side of the news.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the other side of the news. This is Bob Fitrakis.
And Dan Dugan, WGRN 94.1 LPFM, The Green Renaissance.